Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome Dan Renshaw into the studio, and we're going to step back a ways or go up a bit higher and get a bigger view of the context that we've been discussing when we look at Hatcher Pass, mining, and the rest of it. Welcome, Dan.
Well, thank you, Mike. Yes, it's nice to be back.
So when we talk about bigger context, what are we talking about?
Well, I would like to back away far enough that we can see the gold rush as an era.
Okay.
For example, Mike, it started in the Carolinas in the early 1840s. There was the discovery of gold. That was quite appreciable, and it created an interest in that local area that also developed then some techniques for doing placer and hard rock mining of gold. The big discovery of them all was, of course, California. And this background, I have such difficulty in making it more concise. But let me touch on, for example, Mr. Marshall picking up a bit of metal in the tail race of Mr. Sutter's sawmill in California on the American River.
Okay.
This is just out of Sacramento. And he picks it up, and he looks at it, and he says, gosh, what is this? And the tail race had scoured. And he then, when they turned it off, the sawmill was in the process of being constructed, noticed that it had sluiced up some of this strange-looking yellow metal. He suspected it was gold, took it to Sutter, and Sutter said, yes, it is, and we've really got to keep this quiet. Now, that was in January of 1848. At that time, there's still an indecision going on about California because the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that ended the Mexican-American War didn't come until February of 1848. So keeping it quiet had quite a significance. But they couldn't. They couldn't keep it quiet. And probably the biggest tragedy of them all was what happened to Sutter and others who were trying to develop locally and were what happened. In the early days, that first year, the spring and summer of 1848, it was just the locals that were doing the mining. One of the big mining instruments that you need, one of the implements that you'd take with you to the creek, was a bucket for picking up nuggets. I mean, this was incredible, Mike, what it was like in California in the early stages of the gold rush. Never been identified by anybody that was paying attention prior to that. There had been some discoveries of placer gold in Southern California, but they weren't significant enough to create what happened with the discoveries in the Sierra Nevada. The numbers are awfully hard to put together, but the best number is in the range of 60 million ounces that were taken from California in the early days. I mean, it was exceedingly significant, a big, big number for those days. We're familiar mainly with the 49ers that rushed to California a year later.
Right.
And a lot of them were entirely too late to benefit. Some would consolidate into a mining operation that would be able to handle deeper ground, more difficult ground, cheaper ground, and still make a profit. Mm-hmm. But that was phase two. Phase one was 48, when people would come into San Francisco Harbor and it's full of boats and there's nobody. there's you walk into town and it's a ghost town. And everybody was out in the creeks with their bucket. That's where things got really going as far as the gold rush is concerned. The the story on the development of California related to the gold rush has been well known for many years. There was a backwash of sorts. You had all of this rush to California. A lot of the people were too late, didn't have the ability to benefit from any of this. And so they would wander back. They'd gone through the Rocky Mountains and figured, you know, wow, this is some beautiful country. I want to go take a better look at it.
Right.
And so the gold rush went with them, and they made some astounding discoveries in various places. Near Pike's Peak, the big discovery that over the years turned into 30 million ounces in Colorado. And all up and down the Rocky Mountains, the gold rush continued as an era. It worked its way mainly north, went south into Mexico, but Mexico had a long history of mining. There was nothing new when you went down to Mexico. But going north, it was a brand new area up into Canada. One of the first discovered areas was along the Fraser River. Some of the bars on the Fraser River were worth mining, placer mining. And this all led to discoveries at various places on the what's called the Caribou Discovery in the interior of British Columbia. I need to back up just a few years to get another perspective in Canada. During the Civil War, there was a lot of industrial development going on up north in the northern states as the war was progressing. One of these big changes was the telegraph, which was in full use at the time, went pretty much international. And there was a scheme to develop a worldwide network of telegraph. And Western Union bought into this, and they proposed and got government backing for a line that would go from San Francisco up through Canada, through Alaska, across the Bering Strait, and then all the way to European Russia, and the whole world would be connected by telegraph.
Right.
At the same time, there's some competition going on in the form of the laying of the first transatlantic cables, but several of these were miserable failures.
Okay.
So Western Union was determined that this was the way to go. So we're in the 1860s, the latter 1860s, when you've got wire being strung through British Columbia. Today, you can go up the Stikine River to a place called Telegraph Creek, and guess where that name came from? This was part of the line.
Part of the line, right.
From San Francisco up through the, just on the east side of the coastal range. Well, there was some discoveries made by those folks in the 1860s, but it was not followed up. But later, there was a case then where you had people that knew about this that went back there and did some more concerted looking, and it ended up in some significant finds, one of them in the Cassiar area of British Columbia.
Right.
Seasonal mining. The folks would come in the 1870s, and mine seasonally, and then have to leave because of winter conditions. And if you had done well, you could go all the way down the coast on some kind of a steamship and get away from it all. But if you hadn't, you wintered over in Wrangell or Sitka, the two choices. At the same time, then, there comes a interesting character. He originally was born in Germany. His name is George Pauls. And George made it to California and participated in the California Gold Rush. He was a mining engineer trained in Germany at a university. He then became kind of a specialty as mining equipment developed. He became the installer, and he was hired by a group in Sitka to come to Sitka to install a stamp mill. This would have been late 1870s.
Okay.
He gets there, and he's got enough training to realize that, whoa, this geology is fabulous. Nobody's doing any prospecting. Mm-hmm. So he takes it upon himself to organize some prospecting. He had a group of men who were familiar with the prospecting routine for Placer. And it's not that much more difficult to think of Placer and Hard Rock together in the form of these people who are wintering over. Mm-hmm. So he talks a group of them in small groups, two or three together. He would bankroll them, grubstake them with supplies and send them out with the idea that they would share whatever was found in this early day prospecting. There were several groups that he sent out in the summer or early spring of 1879. Two of them that names are probably familiar is Joe Juneau and his partner Harris. And they were sent to the Auk Bay area to do some prospecting there. The story of Juneau and Harris is really sordid, and I would love to pursue it, but I better not right now.
Okay.
The end of it all was that there was an astounding discovery made that later became known as the Juneau Gold Belt. It wasn't a straight line by any means. The contortions that had gone through for this to become acknowledged as a discovery is an amazing story. The summation part of it all is that this was the first gold rush in Alaska. There was everybody out of Sitka got in whatever floated and paddled to what became known as Juneau and staked claims because this was a very, very rich area. Harris had named it Silver Bow Basin in regards to a previous area that I believe Montana that he had come from. But this basin on Gold Creek, above Juneau, contained numerous small, exceedingly rich veins of gold. To begin with, the development was small mining. Later, it turned into big mining. In the fall, when the rush started, in the fall of 1879, a couple of different prospectors got there kind of late. They had, in fact, late both in terms of days, but also they showed up one evening and couldn't quite make it all the way to the usual landing spot at what became known as Juneau. So they made camp on Douglas Island. One of them was, and I don't have names in front of me here, pardon me, but one of these individuals was a significant prospector. If he stopped somewhere, he got his gold pan out, and he was panning the creeks. And this one creek had quite a bit of gold in it on Douglas Island. You know,
kind
right
of an
beach.
Accidental discovery.
Yeah, well, most of them are serendipitous. So he staked some claims on Douglas Island. Later, these claims became known as the Treadwell Mine. Treadwell was an intermediary. He bought the claims, and he started developing of them. But then he sold out also. But his name was appended to five large mines, large meaning at one time, Mike, on Douglas Island, there were 1,000 so. I want to be careful here on my numerology here, but you had, in the early days, stamp mills that did the milling, and they were, in essence, a scale-up of a mortar and pestle.
Okay.
And the larger, real commercial stamps weighed 1,000 pounds. Can you imagine 1,000 of those running at one time, dropping on ore? You know, at one time, this was the scene on Douglas Island.
Okay.
This was in the 1880s and 1890s, all of this development. It brought in enormous number of people who then started developing Juneau as a commercial area, and Douglas Island developed also as a commercial area. Oftentimes you think that later, when the Klondike Gold Rush took place, you left Seattle and you were in wilderness. No, not so at all. There was a lot of development going on, especially in the Juneau Gold Belt.
Right.
at that same period of time of the discovery, 1879-1880, for the Juneau Gold Belt, there had been some, remember that at this time, that we have I have to go back to 1867, where where we transfer from the Russian ownership to ownership by the United States. And the United States undertook this with a benign neglect. It became a military district.
Right.
And the army got over infatuated with it. They left. And then there was nothing. Finally, the Indians, sensing that they were on their own, rebelled in Sitka. And it got so frightening for the locals that are living there, they asked Canada to come help them, which they did.
Okay.
And this kind of embarrassed the United States into finally sending the Navy up. So it's a military district, and it's very poorly administered to begin with. Well, in the late 1879s, the Navy is doing what they can. And one of the big complaints was that the passes into the interior of Canada, especially the Chilkoot Pass, was tightly controlled by the natives. The natives would not let anybody over those passes. The Tlingit Indians on the coast side didn't exactly work closely with the Stick Indians on the other side, but they had an agreement. And they were going to keep the white man out.
Okay.
Well, the Navy, there was an organization, a large group that wanted to make that trip called the Bean Party. And they went to the Navy and said, look, you've got to help us open those passes. So the Navy put on quite a show up in the upper area of Lynn Canal for all of the natives, shooting their cannons and threatening and so on, you will let these people pass.
Right.
That was the first use of the Chilkoot Pass in 1880. And it was a seasonal thing in as much as the people that went in had to come out because there was no way to maintain themselves during that long winter period. So they didn't get very far on a seasonal basis. There was no major discoveries made. Another little trail that I need to go back to, in the same time frame, we've got a guy by the name of Shefflin, and he is noted for the discovery of a big silver mine in Arizona. He was wandering around in the area, the desert area. He had this vision that he was going to find this big silver find. And he's alone, and he's wandering around where the natives are exceedingly hostile. And the military would come across him from time to time, and, you know, what are you doing here? All you're going to find is your own tombstone. And so when he did find what he was looking for, he called it the Tombstone Mining District.
Oh, all right.
Well, Shefflin's a real visionary. And he has a map, and on that map, he's got this big arc drawn of mineralized area. It takes it up through Canada and into Alaska, and he's thoroughly convinced within himself that if he was to travel up the Yukon River, he would intercept that mineral belt. So he does this. He's wealthy, very wealthy, but he's still this wild-eyed wanderer. And he builds a special sternwheeler that he has transported to the mouth of the Yukon River. He has difficulty getting into the mouth, all of those various channels. There was nobody to guide him. So he ends up then traveling up the Yukon River, sampling as he went. By late August, he had only made it to Rampart. And he's from Arizona. That chill wind that was blowing convinced him that he had had enough. So he takes his riverboat down to St. Michael's, and he puts it on the ways, and he leaves. Oddly, the name of the boat is the New Racket.
Oh.
Well, you've got some interesting characters that come in from the Yukon Valley from the east. A principal among them is Arthur Harper and McQuesten and Mayo and Ledoux, a group of early pioneers, and we're, again, in the late 1870s, early 1880s.
Okay.
They make it all the way down the Yukon River and find the new racket laying there. So they have this vision that they're going to open trading posts along the Yukon River, and this boat is just what they need, so they're able to purchase it. And now they're in business. They've got the Alaska Commercial Company backing them. And so the new racket is able to make one trip a year up to stock their new built trading posts. And they're mainly thinking furs. They're not thinking mineral development. But this is a very important part of getting everything established, because now you got people coming in over the Chilkoot Pass that can find trading posts that have supplies they can winter over.
Oh.
So the development slowly gets going, and they start making some interesting discoveries along the Stewart River and the Bars and various other locations as they travel along. So the scene is set for something to be discovered in Alaska. And again, I have to be really concise in the little bit that I would say about a guy named George Washington Carmax, who was a man who came to Alaska wanting to live like an Indian. And he did so, and successfully. And he married an Indian lady. And it was a very good marriage. Unfortunately, she died. And to be a good native, it was necessary for him to follow native tradition. And next, he had to marry her sister.
Okay.
They didn't do well together.
Didn't do well. Okay.
But poor George, he is wanting to persist in being the Indian. He finds himself one day staring into the waters. He tells this vision himself. And he sees there's fish, salmon in the waters. It's clear waters. And he sees a fish that swims upstream and comes right to him, and the fish has huge gold coins for eyes and gold scales, and the water is rippling, and there's this reflection, and he's enticed by this vision, and suddenly it disappears. And he sits there and he says, well, what does this mean? And it tells you a lot about the man that he decided it meant that he should go fishing.
Okay.
So he flips a coin. Should I go upstream or downstream? And it turns out downstream. And it was clear waters that he had seen. So one of the only clear water streams was this place called the Throndike. So he goes down there, and it was a favorite fishing camp anyway. He establishes a fishing camp. how do I make this short? It led to the discovery very serendipitously of the Klondike, what became the Klondike Mining District. That was in 1896, in August. It was an astounding find. You think oftentimes in history, gee, I would like to have been there and seen a certain scene. One of them that I'd like to have been there to see was in McPhee's Saloon at 40 Mile, where it was necessary after staking claims for George Washington Carmax to go downstream to the recording area to record these claims.
Right, right.
And he's not a drinking man, but he walks into McPhee's bar and he orders two drinks and he tosses them down. And everybody knew everybody in the area. All of the prospectors, all of the trappers, they all knew each other, and everybody had a nickname. And for reasons unknown to me, he was called McCormick.
Okay.
So he comes in the bar, and everybody, hey, it's the squaw man, McCormick, you know, and they give him a hard time. And he walks up to the bar, and he tosses these two drinks down. And he turns, and he's got his elbow on the bar. And he, boys, he says, we found it. And they laughed him to scorn, you know.
Sure.
George, what do you know? What are you talking about? You know, gosh, you know, of all the people in the world, you're the last one we'd expect to find anything. So he says, well, look, and he had brought some gold from his find. And his claims, interestingly, later became identified as the richest spot on Earth, the confluence of what became known as the Bonanza and the El Dorado.
Whoa.
Anyway, he had taken time to bring some specimens of nuggets with him, laid them on the bar, and they all rushed up to take a look. And in those days, everybody could identify where gold came from. It has impurities to it. So you can, the conversation was, well, this didn't come from the Stewart. Well, it didn't come from the Pelly either. Well, we can tell it's not from the 40 Mile. You know, where did you find this? As this is going on,
sure.
People exiting out of the back door, and they're heading upstream to the Throndike, and it becomes an exodus of the locals. And all the locals do very good because they get
there. They're there soon.
Yeah. And they all pull upstream.
And he was able, of course, to properly register his claim, or how
he did
that?
Indeed. Yeah, he took the time to register it. And he had left his two brothers-in-law back at the camp, actually at the claims, to defend the claims.
Of course, there are images of what happens when a discovery is made.
And his two brother-in-laws are very interesting. One is called Skookum Jim, and the other is Taggish Charlie. And Skookum Jim got his title because he used to freight over the Chilkoot Pass.
Okay.
He's a stick Indian from the interior. But he's a really skookum individual. He used to carry a multiple 100-pound pack over the pass. So, Skookum Jim is really the guy who made the discovery. But since he was a native, there was a discovery right that allowed you two claims. Well, George took that. So he had two claims in his name, but one claim for Taggish Charlie and one claim for Skookum Jim. And all of the claims were just fabulously wealthy.
Okay, so Mike Malevsky here, and I've been talking with Dan Renshaw essentially about the background flow of early discoveries in California on through parts of Alaska to the discovery of gold in the Klondike.
Right, which brings an influx of people in after the fact, a huge influx of people into the North Country, most of which continued on down the Yukon River and filtered into Alaska. And I'm going to pick a date, and it's a personal, very personal thing for picking this date.
Okay.
It would have been late September, early October of, let me say October of 1918, when the gold rush ended. It ended with the sinking of a ship called the Princess Sophia, which ran hard aground on the Vandenberg Reef just out of Juneau.
And that will be the rest of the story that we'll pick up in the next interview. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mike.